Last week on the show, we discussed depression at some length. A couple of really amazing listeners came on and described their experience of it. And sometimes you blow me away with the things and the honesty that you say them with. And lots of you got in touch then and spoke to us and said, look, depression is one thing, but I have anxiety, which is a different thing. And I'd like to talk about that. And that's what we decided we would do today. So have you or do you suffer from anxiety? How does it impact on you? Do you talk about it? Do you feel it's understood by the people around you? And how hard is it to live your life with a constant, maybe worrying sort of thing going on in your head that undermines you, that maybe impacts on your ability to work or socialize or even just relax? How often do you just feel stressed and have no explanation for it? 53106, I'd love to hear your experience of it. And Gavin, one of our listeners, is on the line. Gavin, talk to me about your experience of anxiety and why you maybe wanted to tell your story.
Yeah, well, I was one of the people who probably contacted you. And as it turns out, I've managed to get mine under control, and only recently, but after 25 years.
Yeah.
So it was a long time to have it. But the reason I contacted you was that I suspect or believe that anxiety in may be more dangerous than depression, in that it's a bit more active, let's say. In my case, I suffered sensations of fear.
Yeah.
And they could be mild or they could be exceptionally strong. And I think when you suffer a sensation of fear, your back is to the wall. So you may end up with a kind of a fight or flight type of response, which I think is, compared to depression, which I've had issues with as well, is kind of more passive, you know. So I think anxiety has the potential to be considerably more dangerous, you know.
When did you first, Gavin, did you first start to feel that sense of fear, that sense of anxiety?
Back in the 90s. Back in the 90s it was for me.
What age were you then?
I would have been in my early 20s.
Okay.
It was, again, just out of control fear. That's what it was. It was out of control fear. Now, a lot of what I learned to recognize incidents of out of control fear, like really bad fear, and learned that it would eventually pass. You know, sometimes it literally just take to the bed and let it pass. But it's very corrosive. It's very corrosive with relationships, because you would have a sensation of things being wrong. And you have this sensation of fear, and you then kind of act accordingly, because you'll end relationships, you'll have rows. But in my case, I was self-employed, and to be self-employed, fear kind of makes you risk averse. And being a risk averse as a business person means you don't drive your business the way you should.
I don't think brave is the word, but you're not maybe as gung-ho or what have you, because you're riddled with fear all the time.
I had a marine business, and I still have, and at one stage developed a fear of sailing. So how do you sell sailing boats when you're afraid of sailing? You know, so that's a simple thing. Now, again, I've managed to get over all this.
Okay.
But it's, it's just fear. And I think it plays second fiddle to depression. I think people don't discuss it as much.
No, I don't think they do.
And it is fear. Now, in my own case, I learned to realize only in recent years that the sensation of fear, I'll give an example. At one stage, I was down the country with my new wife. Everything was going really well. And I had this sensation of fear and utter dread.
Yeah.
And that was that was maybe 10 years ago. And that was the first time I realized that there was a disconnect between the sensation of fear and actual fear. Because at this stage, there was nothing going wrong. Everything was good, and it was sensation. And in future years, I learned that the sensation of fear, in my case, was coming from an immune disorder, which I got diagnosed with in January.
So just to stop you for a second. So you were able to rationalize that.
Yes.
You were filled with fear, but there was kind of no reason. There was nothing to be afraid of. Were you able to sort of see the... groundless fear as such.
What I had to rationalize was that I was suffering an artificially induced sensation of fear, and for years the mistake I made was that I mistook it for the emotion of anxiety. And when you mistake it for an emotion, you look for things to blame like your family, your work, your exam, stress, college, whatever you want, or some run-in you might have, a road rage, something like that, you'll say, this is what's upset me. But when you learn to realise that, in my case, that the sensation was absolutely independent of anything else,
it reminds me of, I remember speaking to a woman about this once years ago, and she was very worried about, there was family issues, and she was kind of obsessively worrying about the family issues. And then the family issues resolved, and you would have thought, well, in that case, all the anxiety and the worry would resolve. And almost with a stroke, the minute the family issues resolved, she started worrying about financial issues. If you're anxious, you'd find something to worry about. Well, doesn't matter what it is.
You've got this sensation of fear, and you're wondering what's causing it. So you look again. If you make the mistake that it's an emotion, you look for things to blame it. Yeah. I remember when penalty points came in, I was convinced I was going to be put off the road. A completely irrational fear. And I purchased a car with a smaller engine because I was convinced within 6 months I was going to be gone off the road. And then, you know, subsequently, when I ordered that car, I saw the colour, didn't like it, rang the dealer, said, look, can you change the colour? He says, you're getting that colour. And didn't sleep for 3 weeks worrying about the colour of the car. So that's when I learned to recognise out-of-control worry.
Can I just ask you, just because I'm conscious we're coming up to the news, I hear how it affected your business, but what about things like relationships? You mentioned having a new wife, so obviously you got married.
Yeah.
Did it impact your ability to be present and connected to people in your life?
Where that got impacted was when I ended up on antidepressants for it.
Okay.
Because the antidepressants change personalities. And I found the antidepressants very dangerous. And I ended up making a complaint to the HPRA about homicidal ideation on a particular antidepressant.
Okay.
So that's where it introduced actual danger into my life. I think the risk of suicide for people who suffer anxiety is higher. But I ended up
I don't mean to cut across you at all, Gavin, but I know we're going to go to news very shortly. But
it's another conversation that needs to be had.
Yeah,
some people do very well on antidepressants,
but
some people have adverse reactions.
Come away from antidepressants for just the second that I want to just ask you about your relationships. Were they hard to maintain?
Let's say before, if we go back to when I was younger, and it would have, boyfriend-girlfriend relationships would have ended sooner probably than they should have.
Right.
As regards with my wife, there would have been times when, before we were married, where I may have tried to end things because things didn't feel right, because I was suffering uncaused fear and associating
with this
is what it was.
You pushed people away, did you? That kind of thing?
Things didn't feel right, but things didn't feel right about work. There was loads of different things that wouldn't feel right, and you'd make a decision. And you were making a decision based on fear.
Yeah, and fear was permeating your every thought. Look, thank you, Gavin. I'm so sorry to I don't. It's not that I want to cut you short. I don't. It's just we're coming up to the news. But thank you for starting this conversation. I think it's a really important one, and I wish you well in every way. And I get a sense that you've come a long way with it, and have a way of managing it now a bit differently. But thank you for that indeed. 53106 is the text, and we're talking about anxiety. Huge amounts of people suffer from it. Huge amounts of people lie awake at night worrying, thinking about things, remembering what they said to somebody and what did that mean. I mean, people worry about social anxiety is a common one, financial anxiety, health anxiety. There are a variety of really common things we worry about as people. And you heard what Gavin said, it affected his business, it could affect his relationships, it affects your peace of mind and your well-being. Let us know if you're relating to all of this. We'll take a short break. And we have been talking about anxiety as well, just before the news, Gavin was on, describing his, I suppose, lifetime of living with anxiety, which he describes as just this constant feeling of fear that interfered with his business, with his relationships, with his, I suppose, peace of mind. He also said off air to us that he never really knew it was anxiety. He never really knew what to call it. He had the sensations, he had the symptoms, but he didn't actually know that it was anxiety. And I think that's probably true of a lot of people who just live with and normalize those feelings of fear. 53106 is the text line. It's 30 cent if you want to get in touch. You can also low call me, 1890 453 106. You can call Ciara on the Lunchtime Live comment line anytime you like, 24/7, 1890 453 108, and we will get back to you. And indeed, you can tweet us at Lunchtime Live NT or at Ciara Kelly Doc, or email us at lunchtimelive@newstalk.com. Now, as I say, we have been talking about anxiety. And Hazel is on the line. Hazel, you got in touch with us saying anxiety is a bitch. It says you make you feel useless. It paralyzes you. And when you are paralyzed and feeling useless, that feeling of useless is kind of validated because you're not able to do anything. And that's just for starters. That's some description, let me tell you. Tell me about your own personal experience of anxiety. You're very welcome, well, by the way.
Thanks, Kara. Lovely to talk to you.
Yeah, you too.
Like Owen, I had no idea that there was a word for what I was going through. So I don't remember a time when I didn't live with anxiety and with those associated feelings of worthlessness.
Yeah.
And really feeling, I mean, it is paralyzing because it's not just that there's something going on in your head that you can't quite put a word on. It's the physical sensations as well. It's the panic attacks. It's the headaches, because I will get migraines when I'm stressed. And of course, I'm most stressed when I'm in the grips of an episode of GAD, of generalized anxiety disorder, which is what I have been diagnosed with. Incredibly tired. Tiredness is very much associated with it because you're just spending so much mental energy trying to get through your day. And sometimes it can just feel like getting from one end of the day to the other is like pushing your way through treacle at a snail's pace going up a hill or something. And it's the palpitations as well that sometimes accompany a panic attack, but sometimes can just happen by themselves. And it's a feeling of terror. Like I could be sitting here in the middle of an anxiety episode and be feeling absolutely terrified and paralyzed by that terror, but not be able to even tell myself why, never mind explain it to somebody else who might be concerned or wanting to support me. Because, you know, I sit there and in my own head I go, well, Hazel, what's wrong with you? What's the fear? What are you afraid of right now? And I can't actually give myself an answer for that except, oh, Jesus, everything. And all the things I haven't done and all the things I should be doing and all the things I should be doing that I don't even know I should be doing.
Yeah.
And it's that catastrophizing then that happens. The anxiety gets bigger and bigger inside you. And it's to try and head it off at the pass and make it stop before it gets, I was going to say out of control, but it's not out of control because it controls you. So the anxiety is in control of something, but you're not in control of it, if that makes sense.
Oh, totally. I used to actually say to people, either you control this or it will control you. And,
mm-hmm.
and people do adjust their lives, don't they, because of anxiety. They make their lives maybe a bit smaller than they need to be.
Yes, exactly. Particularly when you're in the throes of it, because, you know, I've been very lucky that I was eventually diagnosed with anxiety. I have an excellent GP, and I went to her, and I because I was having flashbacks. I have a history of child sexual abuse, and I was in a situation where I was having up to 20 flashbacks a day, and it's not just that you're remembering being abused and you can kind of go, okay, I don't need to remember that right now. I can get on with my day. It's that the actual physical sensations of having somebody slobbering all over you were coming back to me. And I was literally put back into that place again. And I said up to 20 times a day, because I sat down over the course of about a week. And I said, well, it feels like it's happening all the time, but let me put an actual number on it. And I was horrified then when I came up with that number. And I went to the doctor and I said, look, can we do something for this? Because it's totally interfering with my day. And she said, well, talk to me about what else is going on and how else are you feeling? And I, you know, we had a long discussion about that. And she said, okay, sounds to me like you have anxiety. And I looked at her and I said, she doesn't everybody get a bit anxious? She says, yes, but there is an actual, you know, disorder or condition that we can give a name to. And now that, I don't know if you found this when you were practicing here, but sometimes that when you put a name on something,
yeah.
then it becomes a thing that you can deal with.
Yes.
And even if you don't particularly like the name, or you don't particularly like to say, oh, well, look, I have a mental disorder, at least then you know what you're working with, you know what you're dealing with. And once you know what you've got, you can figure out how to deal with it.
I think it's definitely a step towards management. I really do.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. So straight away, she put me on a very, very low dose of medication just to help get over the hump.
Yeah.
And literally within 24 hours, the flashbacks were gone. I was able to sleep soundly. So obviously when you've had a good night's sleep, you're more prepared to tackle the day anyway, whether you have anxiety or not. We all need our sleep. So being able to sleep and wake up and not think, your first thought of the day not being, oh Jesus, I've woken up, now what do I have to do, and what have I failed at already before I even get out of bed, you know, having that removed from me was a huge release of a burden.
And Hazel, can I ask you, because you obviously, and I'm so sorry to hear about your, you know, the history of abuse and everything, and it's no wonder in a way you had, you know, a struggle, because I think that's probably true of everybody who goes through something like that. But you describe living with this terrible fear and panic and all those things. But you didn't recognise that it was maybe anxiety. You just thought, oh, sure, doesn't everyone get a bit anxious? Yeah. You'd kind of normalised it. Did you really never question that the thought never entered your head that you were struggling with anxiety, even though you were having all those very debilitating symptoms?
No, you know, honestly, I didn't know that anxiety was a real thing. You know, that it was a disorder that you could get help for. I just thought I was just not very good at life, and I needed to figure out how to adult better. You know, I thought the problem was entirely with me and of me, and that I just needed to do something to cut myself on. And you know, my self talk would have been incredibly harsh.
I was going to say you were kind of beaten. You were struggling with anxiety to start off with, and then beating yourself up for struggling with it and for not being able to deal with it effectively in some way.
Exactly. And we're not even, you know, but knowing what it was meant that I could get help for it, and meant that I could then go back into therapy with a very clear focus on the goal. It wasn't just, oh, hello, I'd like to feel a bit better about myself. It was like, look, this is what I have. Can you help me with this? So I found, and even finding a therapist who could help, it was great to be able to say, this is specifically what I need help for at this moment in time. And that, of course, is very useful. And you know, practical tips and tricks and tools, and even being able to say to my children, look, I have something, I have a disorder, I have an issue that I need, you know, your help and understanding with. And bless them, they have been very helpful in understanding, you know, because my main area of anxiety now is around my loved ones, which is my children. And if I suddenly have an attack of anxiety, they know that the first thing I'll do is reach out to them and say, you know, I'm having anxiety, or I'm a bit anxious today. I need you to check in with me wherever you are and whatever you're doing. Just let me know that you're okay. Yeah. Because at this stage, they're 15 and 17, and
they get that
you're doing their own thing.
Yeah, you worry. Did your anxiety have any kind of grounding in reality? As in, was there stuff going on that was making you more anxious? Did you have difficulties? Was there, do you know what I'm asking, or was it just completely internally driven, or were you under pressure?
Well, I was under pressure. I was a single parent, on, you know, completely on my own, because obviously I'm estranged from my family as a result of, you know,
the abuse.
The abuse, exactly. Yeah, I don't really want to have them around me or my children.
Okay, fair.
So, you know, I was dealing with raising the kids on my own. And so that brings its own pressures, and its financial pressures, because I didn't have work. I'm still not working. But, you know, those anxieties would be common to anybody in that situation. But it was exacerbated by the fact that I just had this strong internal belief that I was worthless and I was no use and I was wasting my life and I should be, you know, the self-talk was constantly negative. And just, you know, since I got help for anxiety, my life hasn't suddenly improved, but my ability to live my life has improved.
Okay, so your life hasn't changed. You're still a single parent. You still are estranged from your family. You still have tough times, but your ability to process that or deal with that now is different, because your anxiety is under control.
My anxiety is under control. Yeah, for the most part. Of course, I'll still have days where I get anxious.
Sure, we all do.
But exactly. And that's the thing. And that's really why I wanted to talk to you this morning, is for people who are suffering and who don't, because it really is suffering. You know, waking up and hating on yourself every single morning isn't really a healthy attitude to yourself or to your life. And to learn compassion and understanding for yourself, I think, is the first thing that we need to do. But I particularly wanted to talk to you to highlight the fact that it is a real thing.
Oh, I know.
Because it's a real thing that you can get help for. And that there are, you know, even being able to say to other people on social media, you know, this is what anxiety is doing to me today. And then saying, oh, I completely understand.
Yeah.
You know, I understand is such a huge relief to hear from other people who are in a similar position, because there's nothing worse and more terrifying than feeling like you are on your own.
I actually think one of the things, I mean, I know social media can cause anxiety in people too, and it has its own difficulties. But I think for a lot of people who are struggling to interact socially in the real world because of things like anxiety, I think social media sometimes feels like the only place they can interact, because it is a little bit more at a remove or something, so they can deal with it a little bit better. We rarely hear about that, actually.
Oh, yeah, I don't have to put on makeup or get out of my pajamas to tweet, you know, thank God.
If anyone saw what we looked like when we were tweeting. James says about you, Hazel is so courageous. I am glad she's getting help. I hope it's working for her. I wish her the best for recovery for her anxiety and hope she finds peace and happiness. You do sound to me like you, despite what has obviously been a tough old road, you sound like you sound like somebody who isn't quite as hard on themselves perhaps as you once were, and that maybe is a bit kinder to themselves now. Is that true?
That is true. I suppose I have a different perspective on it, and I don't see that everything in the world is my fault. And I don't tend to try and take responsibility for things that aren't my own fault. But I'm still in therapy. I probably will always have a therapist on hand, whether or not I'm actively going. But I realise that, you know, sexual abuse isn't something that you just recover from. But there are stages of healing, and things do get better, and life does get better, and you know, that your ability to manage the life that you have improved. And I think our awareness now, and the fact that people are speaking more openly about their histories, helps as well. Because, you know, if you're no longer keeping the secrets, that's not burdening you anymore. And being able to open up to people about why exactly you're feeling pretty crap about yourself and have them turn around and say, but that's not how I see you.
No, you know, people rarely see us through such a bleak prism as we see ourselves.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, it's really wonderful when somebody just, you know, I've said it before, but a smile can save a life. You know, that just that bit of human interaction and somebody seeing you as a worthy human being, even that can help a little bit with anxiety. You think, oh, well, God, if they think I'm worth 5 minutes to chat to in the supermarket, then maybe I'm not such a terrible person after all. We're community, I suppose, and we need to mind each other and mind ourselves.
You are absolutely right, Hazel. Thank you for coming on and talking to me.
Absolute pleasure. Thanks for taking the time.
I'm delighted, and I hope you go from strength to strength. I do sometimes think that once you start moving down the road to recovery, that's an unstoppable force too. There's always setbacks, you know, little speed bumps, but you keep going, and it sounds to me like you were doing exactly that. And I wish you all the good times in the world. I hope that, you know, things get easier going forward, and I have a feeling perhaps they will, but thank you. Fiona is also on the line. Fiona, you have an interesting form of anxiety. You have OCD, which is of course an anxiety disorder. Tell me a little bit about that. You're very welcome, by the way.
Hello, hi. Can you hear me?
I
now
can hear you
all that?
Loud and clear.
Good, great. Okay, so I'm currently feeling very anxious. So completely. I'm totally fine about it. So I have OCD. I got my diagnosis about 7 years ago, but I suppose up until that point, I would never have actually kind of identified with being anxious at all. I would have felt that I was very controlled and also laid back, which in itself is perhaps a bit of a paradox. But so looking back, I probably always had a tendency to use my mind to control my feelings. So when I was really little, I used to kind of skip certain steps or certain cracks. I always had to have certain things on me to keep calm. Like I used to have a little doll I carried around my neck. And then I kind of would calculate things repeatedly. So like when I was doing my Leaving Cert, I would spend maybe 3 hours a day kind of calculating different types of configurations of points. And if I made a mistake, I would start again at the beginning and go again. And I had various prayer rituals that I had in my head. But nobody knew about this at all.
Of course. So you had rituals, though, little compulsive rituals.
Yeah. Loads of rituals. But I didn't, when I look back on it, like they often call OCD the secret illness. And one of the reasons for that is that it's really a way of managing your anxiety when anxiety comes up in your body. It's a way of attempting to manage it, which basically you did something once and it made the anxiety not, you didn't feel it. And so you keep doing it and it turns into this cycle where you just do more and more and more of those things, even though they might be completely bizarre. And I suppose in comparison to other things, you know, they're bizarre, so you don't talk about them, you know, and so it's all kind of happening within you. And obviously, when people hear OCD, what people tend to think about is people kind of washing their hands or flicking stitches. Or they kind of very often, like, I mean, still a lot of my friends would say to me, you know, oh, I'm so OCD, I love my towels to be all in alignment, whatever.
Yeah.
And OCD has absolutely nothing to do with a desire for your towels to be in a particular way. It's something that you're doing because you feel anxious and you think, if I do this thing, or you have experiences of this thing distracts you, and then you get caught in a loop. So I probably had all of that going on, but kind of managing and doing well in life, did well in university, did well in my career, all those kinds of things, managed all my relationships well. It never kind of bled in. So, like, I would probably have been not fully kind of completely in the loop with it all the time, even though it did take up a lot of time. But then when I got pregnant with my first son, actually, it started really to ramp up because swine flu was a thing at the time, and I am asthmatic. So I kind of became very obsessive about contamination and being afraid that I was going to get swine flu.
Okay.
But of course, because that was so much in the media at the time and people were genuinely worried, I think it kind of, people didn't notice because it actually seemed relatively normal to be worried. And I probably hid how worried I really was.
For sure.
So it was really after in the middle of my second pregnancy, really having all this going on that I really hadn't really dealt with or didn't know I needed to deal with even. It just really, it kind of spiraled out of all control and really took over all my waking hours. And I kind of got to the stage I couldn't really manage work. I couldn't really, you know, like, I was just like a ghost in my own life, and I was completely trapped in kind of these repeated rituals, most of which were in my head. So anyone seeing me would see that maybe I was like if you had a video camera and looked at me, you would probably see I was a bit flatter than normal, but I was still more or less doing what I needed to do until about midway through the pregnancy. And I think it was the reality of knowing I was going to have a second child, and that having two kids, and sleep deprivation is particularly difficult for people with OCD. It tends to make things much worse. And I was living in England at the time, so all my family were in Ireland. And I suddenly just thought, I can't do this anymore. And I kind of talked to my midwife about it, and she didn't quite get it at the time, but I was lucky because at that time, which is 2012, in the UK, there was an established perinatal psychiatry service. So I had access to a specialist midwife, which I think there is a bit more of here now than there was at that time. And so she kind of, like, gradually we kind of teased it out. But I was, I mean, like, I didn't take any medication while I was pregnant. I started after I had my son. But and they had an amazing service. So I had, you know, therapy from the time that my child was 10 days old with him, because I was breastfeeding him. I had a range of people to support me, like an occupational therapist, a nursery nurse. I was able to stay at home with my son. Life kind of continued as normal as I managed to kind of work on the OCD behavior. But I have had, like, for a lot of women who get OCD, it can be your first time getting it in pregnancy, or you can have had symptoms like I had that then kind of ramp up when you get pregnancy, as there's more responsibility in your life.
Yeah.
And so that was kind of how it was for me. So now I would say I live with this. But I've had loads of help. I've been very, very, very fortunate.
We're greater in Irish than. Well, I only broke my leg when I fell off the ladder. I was very fortunate. You know, it's still really,
do you know what I mean?
It's still really hard. You're
totally.
Obviously managing it better now, but nonetheless, I can only imagine what it is. Obviously, it came between you and kind of everything at one stage.
Oh, completely. And I mean, I would still say, you know, I think actually during that period of time when I was in the UK, where there were really well-established services, as soon as I started to get treatment, it took about 4 months, and then basically life just continued and probably was much better, because actually I understood much more some of my own behaviour, and it was great. But when I came back to Ireland, we came back to Ireland 5 years ago, and it's much harder to navigate the system here. And also because I was doing really well, generally the feedback that I got when I asked about support was that I didn't really need it, and that probably I had just had OCD in the perinatal period. And I was like, I don't know, you know. And so I kind of really was pushed into finding different ways of managing it myself.
Right.
So I got very involved with acceptance and commitment therapy, which is still something I'm very involved with in terms of with the community that does the science of that. I didn't actually have a practitioner at the time. And then I kind of got involved in mindfulness, and then I was training to be a mindfulness teacher. And we had, as part of our training, we had to go on a 5-day silent retreat. Silent retreat. And we had two of those over 2 years. And the first one, it was kind of a little hard, but I kind of got through it. I had enough strategies to get through it. But in the second one, like, some things had changed in my life. We had to move out of our home, and there was just various stuff going on. And my stress level was much higher. And I didn't realise the extent to which this was probably not the right choice for me at the time. And so it kind of triggered a major relapse, which lasted a very long time.
God, it just shows you to be very careful. There are a lot of well-meaning things people do, but I don't know if I could go on a 5-day silent retreat. I think I might go, I don't particularly have anxiety, but I think I might go off my head a little. Do you know what I mean? I think that would be very challenging for a lot of people.
And that's kind of what it's meant to do. In a way, what you go on a silent retreat to do is to get in touch with the way that your mind reacts to all the things that stress you out. But obviously, you kind of need to be in a relatively good place for that to work. And I suppose, if I had had something else going on, it might have been easier for the people working with me to see it. But because OCD is so secretive, I had probably begun the kind of pathway to relapse without even noticing it. And they couldn't see it in me either. So I looked completely ordinary on this retreat. I think towards the end, I was a little bit upset and kind of crying a bit, but that's quite normal on a retreat. And so I don't think that it was obvious to people the level or the extent of the distress that I was in.
Yeah.
And at that point, really, and the major mistake I made, and it was, when I say mistake, how was I to know, was that I kind of intensified my mindfulness. I was like, okay, I just need to, I need to get more into it. I need to do more of it. And then that became a bit obsessive. So I was kind of doing 2 or 3 hours of meditation.
Okay,
a day,
so you were obsessing. Yes. Yeah. Okay.
Totally. And had no idea.
So you had OCD, you became obsessive about your treatment for the OCD, and that became feeding.
Well, no, specifically the mindfulness, which I think is a bit, because in OCD sometimes people can be very like you can have scrupulosity, which is that you're trying to do everything really accurately in a religious sense. And so I had probably had a bit of that as a kid in terms of being Catholic, but grew up and then that was no longer as relevant in my life. And so I kind of transferred that to the mindfulness. So I was very obsessive about committing to this mindfulness and being really, really perfect at it in a way that was completely excessive and rigid and out of control.
Yeah.
And I think what I've learned from it, I never finished that training fully in the end. But what I learned is that sometimes we think that, as you say, well-meaning is one thing, but also we get a lot of information that, if you have anxiety, mindfulness is a really helpful strategy. And it can be if you are having, I use mindfulness still a lot, but I had to do a lot of work with really good professionals to help me use it properly again, having had those difficulties with this.
Yeah.
And it's an amazing strategy. But if you have vulnerabilities or if you have trauma, like Hazel, I kind of had a previous history of sexual violence, and some of that kind of said, if mindfulness in terms of paying attention to what you're doing is fantastic, but meditation, which is extended periods of just sitting with yourself, if you don't have a chance to process that with someone, it can be a little bit challenging for some people at some times.
Yeah, look, thank you.
That's kind of how it went.
Look, Fiona Canis has tweeted, she says, amazing discussion, Kira. Important to tell people recovery is possible. It might never go away, but you do learn to manage it. I am proof. Hashtag OCD. Thank you for raising it. Thank you for raising it too, because I don't know that we hear, I think you're right. We kind of stereotype it as somebody, switching on and off light switches or washing their hands, but that might be a manifestation for some people, but that's not the crux of it. It's the constant rituals, the constant... obsessions, the constant trying to manage these coping strategies that are starting to rule your life. But thank you, and I really do mean it. For anybody who has been affected by what Fiona has said, or what Hazel has said, or what Gavin has said, Aware have a free phone number, 1800 80 48 48 1800 80 48 48 48. And I think it's probably worth mentioning, because I just listening to both Hazel and indeed to Fiona there, both of them have a history of sexual violence. The fallout from sexual violence goes on and on and on. And that is why, to be fair, I think we should throw the book at the perpetrators of it, because their victims live with it for a lifetime. And the Rape Crisis Helpline is 1800 77 88 88 77 88 88. We'll come back with more after this. Now, you're very welcome back to Lunchtime Live with Ciara here on News Talk. 53106 is the text, and we're talking about anxiety. And I have been talking to listeners who have been amazing, telling us their stories about their struggles with anxiety. Some says, Ciara, thanks for talking about anxiety. I wake up afraid most days. I have to work hard to correct that feeling, because there's really nothing to be afraid of. My mum is a survivor of child sexual abuse, so in a way I've learned the world is a scary place from her. Although, to be honest, she's an inspiration. As a grown woman now with a family of my own and a busy career, I know these feelings aren't real, but the effort involved in overcoming constant feelings of fear and relating it to all aspects of my life is really tiring. Thank you again for talking about it. And that's from Sarah. Sarah, you're right. Anxiety is exhausting. There's no two ways about it. And someone else says, Ciara, thank you for discussing anxiety. I've had it since I was a child and manage it much better as I get older, but with a lot of work every day. There is no other way. I had to accept it. Hearing this discussion reminded me that I am in a bad patch at the minute, and I have to get some perspective again and to be aware of how I get and how unnecessary it is. Thank you so much for talking about it. Please do it regularly. I am one of the lucky ones who recognises, accepts and manages my anxiety. So many people don't. Programmes like this remind you that it's okay to accept you suffer with something, and that it is also common but not spoken about. I'd love to hear a discussion about anxiety and instability and playing the victim. This is why people hide and why suicide continues to rise. I'm not entirely certain what I don't know what you mean by anxiety equals unstable. Oh, I'm sorry, I do understand. You're saying that people, when you tell them you're anxious, they think you're playing the victim. They think you're unstable, and that's why people hide it. Yeah, totally. These things are misunderstood, and people often project their own, I suppose, lack of understanding onto other people. You're dead right. Thank you for that. And Mary is on the line. Mary, you experience a lot of anxiety with regard to your health. Tell me about that.
So basically, I've always been a bit of a worrier. I've always been a bit of an anxious person ever since I was a child. And I've always been prone to being slightly paranoid about things because I've had insecurity issues and everything like that. But back in 2015, I was out celebrating, basically. This is just a little bit of a background as to how this all started. I was out celebrating and I went to a friend's house. And I smoked a bit of weed, as sure. You might do when you're celebrating. And it was weird because this is how it happened. I was sitting at the table looking at my friend. And my friend said, hey, do you want to come out and look at the balcony? And I was like, yeah, sure. Have a look at, you know, whatever was down there. And basically, a thought crossed my mind. I could jump off this. And it frightened me because it was the first intrusive thought that I had ever had. And then it just, my panic spiraled from there. And basically, the next hour was filled with me pacing and being held by somebody that I didn't even know, with my heart feeling like it was going to beat out of my chest. Okay. I remember at one stage asking for an ambulance to be called because I actually thought that I was having a heart attack.
Okay, so you had a panic attack. Okay, a couple of things. And I feel like I'm going to have to switch hats for a second. But for a start, weed makes people paranoid. A lot of people, when they smoke, do get a bit, you know, messed up in their thinking and they get scared of things. So that's not unusual. Did it continue though when you hadn't smoked weed afterwards?
Yeah, you see, and I haven't actually smoked weed since because of that.
It doesn't suit you, so maybe that's a good thing.
No, it doesn't. But tell me about
your health anxiety. Is that what's going on for you?
Yeah, so ever since then, I had kind of been very conscious of my heart and my heartbeat, and even just hearing my heartbeat would make me anxious. And I noticed that I had a slight irregularity, and I thought that the panic attack that I'd initially had done some kind of damage. And every day I was worried about, like, doing exercise or feeling like having a weird feeling in my chest, even though it could be tension related from my back. It would just send me into this spiral where I would just go into my head and pace around, and just it's weird. It's like when you start to panic, when you focus on something, it's almost as if like you get blinkers on, you can't see anything else, and you're just focused on how bad the feeling is. And so, I've gone to the doctor. I go to the doctor maybe about once every 2 months to do something at this stage. Like, it's awful. So it started off with the heart, and I got my heart checked out. I got a Holter monitor put on, and that was fine. But, you know, I still have tension and fatigue, and I still worry about stuff. You know, if it's not my heart, it's my head. If it's not my head, it's, you know, like if I'm breathing properly, it's just okay. if my body feels any odd sensation at all, okay. It just sends me into a what if it's, you know, worst case scenario.
Health anxiety is one of the commonest focuses. Have you ever considered, Mary, that what you haven't got is anything wrong with your heart or your head? You just suffer with anxiety like tons of people.
No, I know, and that's the thing. It's just it's very hard to just, because when you think that, you know, I just think that I'm under threat.
Okay.
And it just makes it hard to.
Are you able to stand back at all and kind of recognize that you're not under threat? Can you see it that there's the, I don't know if you heard Gavin, he was on earlier, and he was saying that he just found things to worry about, that it, you know, if he wasn't worrying about this, whatever this was, he'd be worrying about that. And if you are anxious, you'll find a focus for that anxiety. In your case, the focus appears to be health related, your breathing, your heartbeat, you know, those things. And that's an actual real common one, to be honest. I often say health anxiety people have the worst, because if your money worries are your focus of anxiety, what's the worst that can happen? You go bankrupt. But if your health worries are your thing, what's the worst that can happen? You think you're going to keel over. But it's just another focus for anxiety. And what really needs to happen is the anxiety gets treated. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, it does. It does completely. And I have gone to therapy before, and I am actually in the system now to go for therapy. Soon enough, I'm on a waiting list, so
okay.
Hopefully it'll be sooner rather than later. But yeah, it's just, you know, I mean, say last night, for example, this is going to sound absolutely mental, but I was lying in bed.
I promise you it's not.
Trying to fall asleep, and I was acutely aware of the feeling of my eyes moving around under my eyelids. I had this weird kind of pinching feeling in the centre of my head, like just in the middle of my forehead, and that was distracting me and making me kind of freak out a bit. It's weird, and like, you know, I do wake up in the middle of the night sometimes with like a racing heartbeat just out of nowhere, out of sleep.
You're probably having anxiety dreams. It's not unusual, by the way, just so you know. There are people with anxiety and they focus on their bodily functions. They focus on breathing or heartbeats, or as you say, the back of your eye moving. A lot of them focus on their swallow. I'm not trying to suggest other things for you to worry about. And there's names for it. Like the swallow one is called globus hystericus, which I think is actually a slightly patronising term. But what it means is you start to become panic stricken about your ability to swallow. So we know this is a thing. But look, I can't diagnose people over the airways, and nor should I. And equally, I can't tell you what you should do. But some people need medication as well as therapy. And I'm not some proponent for big pharma. But I've always said to people, if medication is going to be the game changer for you, then you need to take it, because there's no prizes for being unwell and off medication. You know what I mean? That's there's no prize for that in life. You'd be better off to be well and on the medication. And I don't know if that's what you need or you don't need, but I think you do need to go and talk to your GP maybe again, would you?
Yeah. No, I think I should. It just makes things hard for me. Like, I'm sitting in work and suddenly this weird feeling comes over me and I feel like I have to get up and run out the door and just compose myself and convince myself that I'm not going to pass out or keel over. And it could just be because I've gotten a bad sleep the night before, but it's still the feeling of
tiredness makes it worse. I remember, just last thing for you, as a kind of a look, we've all kind of been there. I remember when I was first a junior doctor and a medical student, and I'd be doing ward rounds in the Mater Hospital, and there'd be huge teams of doctors, and you always thought everyone knew more than you did. And I remember I went through a phase of my heart racing on those ward rounds and kind of having palpitations, and I obviously was learning a huge amount about cardiology and stuff at the same time. And I started imagining, a bit like you with your Holter monitor, all the different things that could be wrong with my heart. And then one day I was lying in bed and I was thinking about all the different things that could be wrong with my heart. And I suddenly went, this is anxiety. This is me worrying about my heart because I'm in a new job as a junior doctor, and it's bloody terrifying, and it's anxiety. And I was on a ward round about 2 days later and my heart raced, and I actually said to myself, ah, there's the anxiety again. And it just stopped, and it never came back. It just went away, because I got it. I could see that I was in a very stressful situation. It's not, and I was sleep deprived and all of that. And that's you. That's you too, Mary. We, you know, sometimes our heads play tricks on us a little bit.
Yeah, and it's a lot of like, I need to learn how to separate. Like, I know I need to learn how to separate myself and from my thoughts. It's just hard, you know, because as you said, it's not money worries. It's, what is this weird feeling? This could be something really bad, you know. So I think that's why it's a bit harder for me to kind of
the chances of it being something really bad are absolutely minute. I mean, genuinely minute. I think you need to go back and chat and say, I have anxiety putting me up the walls. It started after a bit of weed, but it's kept going. And I think I need a bit of a help. And sometimes, and I'm not saying what you do or don't need, sometimes being on a waiting list for therapy isn't quite enough and you need some intervention in the meantime. But look, come here to me. The best of luck. It gets better, you know. People get on top of this stuff.
Yeah, I have my ups and downs, but it is, I find myself getting better at dealing with some aspects of it, and then other aspects of it slightly kind of crop up a bit in terms of the whole head stuff. And yeah.
Look, thank you for talking to us. I think a lot of people will relate to you. And Catherine is also on the line. Catherine, you have anxiety too, is that right? Have I lost you, Catherine?
No.
No, hi, Catherine.
2 years ago. Hi, yeah. So about 2 years ago, I realised there was something wrong. I wasn't really sure. I was also, it was around when I was diagnosed perimenopausal. I went to the doctor and was given tablets, begins with a D, I can't really remember. But they never really worked. But I found my main issue was when I was on a sun holiday and it was heat. But I still didn't understand why. So last year, I was only prescribed Xanax last year. And the doctor was quite strict and said, look, I don't want to see you ever coming back for these again. And he gave me about 28 of these tablets. Now, they did last me for about a year, actually. And I only took them when I needed it. But I'm finding this anxiety happens when I'm in extreme heat in so definitely not in Ireland. But when I'm just back from holidays and I was away for 9 days. And out of the 9 days, I had to take one of these for 7 days.
Okay.
And it either comes over me when I first wake up in the morning and we didn't have air conditioning. And I feel that was an issue because last year on a holiday, we did have air conditioning. So more and more I'm thinking it's the heat because come the evening time, I'm a happy bunny. I'm fine. But for about as long as if I don't take this flaming tablet, I'm terrible. I'm scared. I don't know why I'm scared. Nothing happened to make me scared. And it's the most awful sensation in the world. Like some of your callers today, I was so much in union with them. I said, God, can we have a chat together? Because what can I do to stop it? And why has it suddenly happened? Also, well, in Ireland now, I get issues on a Sunday night, even though I like my job. But on a Sunday night, I'll go to bed at about 10:30, and by 3 a.m, I've woken up and
yeah,
I'm
have the Sunday night fear.
Terrified.
Yeah, it's a thing,
it's
the Sunday
awful.
Night fear. It really is.
It's just terrible. So I've had in the space of 2 years, I've had 3 months worth of the Xanax prescribed. So I'm not popping a pill every day of the week.
Yeah.
It does help, but I do find it weird that I have to have this. What's overcoming me? Because there's nothing particularly triggering the fear, except what I could only surmise now is having just come back from my holidays, the sun and the heat was definitely a factor.
Okay.
Compared to my holiday last year, because I was, like I said, I had to take one nearly every day, whereas last year I remember I only took one or two. Now they work, which is great, but some days it takes longer to work than others, and as a result,
they're also
highly
addictive, so they're not the best treatment for anything. What I would say to you, not only can I not diagnose over a phone line, but I shouldn't either. But what I would say to you is this: you sound a little bit, Catherine, like you struggle with anxiety anyway. Certain things trigger it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Sunday nights, heat, you know, being out of your normal routine, things like that affect you. And when you're somebody who has that underlying predisposition, things will set you off. But actually, the underlying predisposition is the issue. Xanax is not the treatment long term because it's got too many other problems associated with it. But, you know, maybe it's time to go and talk about the underlying reason why things like a bit of heat or things like Sunday night set you off. Do you know what I mean? That maybe it's a bit, I don't know. But anyway, look, I think there are people who will relate exactly to what you're saying right now. And I suspect there are many of them too. And thank you for coming on and sharing that. And thank you to everybody. Okay. Thank you to Catherine and thank you to Mary and Fiona and everybody, Hazel, everybody, Gavin, who I've spoken to today. Let's take a short break. We'll come back after this with, I think, maybe seagulls.